When we think of Ivan Andreyevich Krylov, his name immediately brings to mind, of course, the fables for which he's celebrated to this day. And rightly so, for even two centuries later, the role he has assumed is something akin to that of a Russian Aesop or La Fontaine. In spite of the lasting fame they brought him, however, Krylov did not actually turn his pen to writing fables until his middle age. Up until that point, he tried his hand at such varied pursuits as journalistic writing, lyric poetry, and dramatic pieces, all of which arguably served as preparation for his true calling as a fabulist. The topic of this paper is Krylov's last play, Urok Dochkam, or, as I will refer to it, A Lesson for Daughters. This play was written in 1806 and 1807, between the writing of Krylov's first fables and their publication, and so it can be understood in this greater context of his oeuvre as a natural stepping stone from dramatic works to fables, not only through the didactic nature of the play, as suggested by its title, but also through the fact that, as an imperial librarian, he would later include it in a list of books recommended in all fields of knowledge. Aside from how popular it was during its time, one of the most interesting things about this play from our perspective is that Krylov wrote it to make fun of the Russian nobility's obsession with French culture, but he used the French model of Molière's Les Précieuses Ridicules, or The Affected Young Ladies, in order to do so. I embarked on this project with the question of why, in a satire of Gallimania, a Russian playwright would take on a French model in order to make his point. That question has led me to focus on processes of adaptation taking place in a Russia at war with France, and what this play suggests about the shifting framework of Russian-French cultural relations during this time. Despite the play's undeniably French origins, Krylov succeeds in transposing Molière's play from 17th century France to 19th century Russia by reinterpreting the satire of the original into a form relevant to the concerns of his own environment. Through this process, the Russian playwright adapter is able to appropriate the French cultural product for purposes other than those intended by its original creator, and the process of adaptation thus becomes a tool of war that effectively allows Russians to use their own enemies' weapons against them. And this, I argue, is an illustration of a larger phenomenon taking place in the second half of the 18th century and the very first part of the 19th, the movement of translated French literature from the center to the periphery of Russian culture. As far as this play is concerned, the majority of critics have acknowledged Krylov's debt to Molière. But Krylov did not take Molière's play and translate it into Russian in the normal sense of the word. On the other hand, the process of adaptation resembles that of translation closely enough that I believe it's not unproductive to approach these two plays with the same principles of translation theory in mind. The translation or adaptation we're dealing with here is not solely linguistic in nature, but also cultural, to the extent that we have the transmission of formative ideas concerning the nature of cultural identity rather than simple word-to-word correspondences. Translation studies scholar André Lefebvre has contended that the study of translation should be subsumed under the more encompassing heading of rewriting. I believe it is useful to include adaptation under that heading as well. Translation as we think of it, that is, as a process that produces a final product that is faithful to the original, differs from adaptation in that the latter is bound to the original to a much lesser degree. Operating with these definitions, we can say that Krylov has adapted Molière's text, and furthermore, that the new subject matter in Krylov's reworking of Molière's play invites us to examine the shifting between languages, both within the text and outside it, and what that movement in the space between one language and another may represent. To that end, I'll begin by telling you a little bit about both of these plays before bringing my focus to the issues at hand. So, in A Lesson for Daughters, the nobleman Vilkarov, frustrated with the effects of the Francophile education that his daughters Fiokla and Lukeria had received in Moscow, has taken them to live in the provinces, intending to find suitable husbands for both of them. In order to combat his daughter's Gallimania, he has forbidden the use of any language other than Russian under his roof. The girls have a maid who relates this state of affairs to her lover, Semyon, who serves another master who happens to be passing through the area. The two have been reunited by chance after a long separation. Because the only obstacle to these two servants' marriage is that of money, Semyon decides to take advantage of Vilkarov's hospitality by masquerading as a Russian-speaking French marquis who requires monetary aid to return home to France. The announcement of the marquis's arrival sends Fiokla and Lukeria into a frenzy. They hang on his every word, no matter how ridiculous it may be. They entertain designs of marrying him and secretly dispatch letters of rebuff to the suitors their father favors. Semyon's disguise, unfortunately for him, ultimately falls apart due to his complete ignorance of the French language. Pressed for his name, he identifies himself as the only marquis he's ever heard of, Marquis Glagol. Fiocla and Lukiria are not sufficiently acquainted with their own culture even to realize that this is actually a Russian name, but Fiokarov is not fooled. Although he is initially angered by the ruse, he ultimately allows the servants to go free on the grounds that they have given his daughters a good lesson. The conflict between Russian and French notwithstanding, this plot is very similar to that of Molière's The Affected Young Ladies, in which the bourgeois gentleman Gorchibus is also annoyed with his daughter, Madelon, and his niece, Cato. Madelon and Cato are obviously not guilty of gallimania, but they form the object of the play's satire due to their préciosité. At the start of the play, Madelon and Cato have just come to Paris from the province and rebuffed the suitors Gorchibus has chosen for them. These suitors decide to teach the young ladies a lesson by sending their valets to court them in the guise of Parisian noblemen. The first valet introduces himself as the Marquis de Mascarille after he ingratiates himself with the girls, who excitedly received him based solely on his noble title. Mascarille is joined by the Vicomte de Jodelet, who is actually another valet. The events of this play culminate in an impromptu ball when the original suitors return and reveal the ruse. The play ends with the suitors taking off with their servants and Gorchibus furiously chastising the girls' short-sightedness. In this way, Molière's play mocks the provincial preoccupation with Parisian airs and appearances within France, much as Krylov mocks the Russian preoccupation with all things French. The characters in A Lesson for Daughters, for the most part, can speak either French or Russian, that is, the noble characters, and the choice of which language to speak is motivated by particular value judgments about culture. We see both the father and his daughters obsessed over the appearances that come along with speaking either language. For Gilharov, keeping his daughters from speaking French also keeps them away from the behavior associated with French culture that he finds so objectionable. For his daughters, French is a marker not only of all the fun they were having reading novels and going to plays and balls and whatnot in Moscow, but also of the fact that they have received a French education. Now that they're in provincial Russia, they're bored out of their minds and look down on everyone around them for not speaking French, which for them might as well mean not knowing what culture is at all. One is reminded of Voltaire at the Prussian court. I know this was mentioned at the plenary lecture yesterday, but where he happily remarked that the court language was French and that only the horses speak German. The daughters in both plays learn a difficult lesson about fixating on appearances. In particular, Fiocla and Lukiria of A Lesson for Daughters are punished at the end of the play for blindly going along with anything as long as it is somehow French. Some of the funnier moments are, for example, when one of the girls complains that the only voice worth listening to is that of their pet parrot, even though the only thing he can say is, vous êtes insulte. Or when the false marquis is asked what the most popular reading material is in Paris these days. How should he know? He improvises the answer that, in fact, no authors are read in Paris nowadays. And that is enough to lead the girls to the ludicrous conclusion that even in Paris, people only speak French, they do not read it. In any case, just as the pair of young ladies in Molière's play have imprinted on the markers of Parisian high society as a symbol of their ideal, so have the young ladies in Krylov's play identified French culture itself as an ideal, distinct from the Russian reality in which they live. Since what marks French culture for Fiocla and Lukiria is the French language, the Marquis, whoever he is defined before he even steps in the room. They fawn over Simeon because he's presented first as a Frenchman and only then as a nobleman. In your handout under numbers 1 and 2, you have the corresponding scenes in both plays where the Marquis's arrival is announced for the first time. I'm not going to read this. It would probably involve funny voices and stuff. But moreover, what follows in both plays, which is not included here, is a scene in which the young ladies fuss over the details of their toilette. Clearly, both pairs of young ladies they share the same concern with appearances. Not only are they obsessed with appearing to be cultured, or in the case of Fiocla and Lukiria, educated themselves, but they also trust that their suitors' noble titles are a sufficient guarantee of noble quality. And as the Marquis de Mascarille tells Madelon and Cato and the Affected Young Ladies, people of quality know everything without ever having learned anything. For Mascarille and Jodelet, assumed nobility is their in with the young ladies, so to speak. When their true identities are revealed, they're stripped not only of their titles, but also of their clothes, which it turns out they've borrowed from their masters. So really, it is the clothing signifying nobility that functions as the primary tool by which the real noblemen are able to teach Madelon and Cato their lesson. Point being, there was nothing wrong with the original suitors as they were, other than that they weren't willing to sit around with girls and talk about writing poetry for the sake of being able to say they write it. The false noblemen show that putting on some fancy clothes and starting off some nonsense in the guise of poetry turns them into exactly what young ladies like Madelon and Cato are really after. Such a poem appears on your handout under number 3, which I will not declaim, but I'm sure you can use your imagination. It is absolutely trite. The rhymes are completely hackneyed, and the last line is just awful. Stop thief, stop thief, stop thief, stop thief. Especially that final line reveals that practically no sensibility, no poetic sensibility at all is required on the reader's part to discern that this poem is basically without aesthetic value. This is further substantiated by Mascagni's subsequent commentary on his own work, in which he draws special attention to the extraordinary quality of the oh that opens the poem. Madelon responds by pronouncing the 4 iterations of au voleur to be spiritual and gallant, strongly suggesting that the young lady's interest in the markers of high culture is just as superficial as Fiocla and Lucchieri's interest in education. They are capable of touting the hallmarks of Parisian culture, but remain woefully incapable of judging it properly, even if they suffer from a constant desire to do so. We might even posit that the young ladies themselves are voleurs of that culture. They do not own it in a legitimate way. So in their search for a life that reads like a romance novel, they hinge everything on the predetermined categories with which they're most familiar, those things that evoke their ideas of what high society must be like. Courtship, poetry, song, fancy dress, soirees, balls. This preoccupation leaves them blind to what is actually of substance, or, as Mascagni says in his last lines, only vain appearances are valued here, and unadorned virtue remains repudiated. C'était la vertu toute nue. Which is also relevant since he is naked at that point, but going on. In A Lesson for Daughters, for Simeon, the inn with Fiocla and Lucchieri is, of course, his purported ability to speak French, which in this case signifies that they may trust him to be a spokesperson for French culture, just as they trusted their French governess before him. His disguise, however, has little to do with physical clothing. The story he tells Yelkarov is that bandits have made away with all of his worldly possessions, which is convenient because it implies he can appear at the estate wearing what he normally does with a ready-made excuse. It is precisely Vilkadov's rule prohibiting the use of non-Russian languages in his household that opens the door for Simeon to take on his masquerade. And given the play's preoccupation with matters of language, it is no accident that Glagol is the marquisal name that Simeon comes up with on the spot. This choice exemplifies the tensions between the Russian and French tendencies in the play. It's a reference to the Russian translation of a popular French novel by Abbé Prévost, Mémoires et aventures d'un homme de qualité qui s'est retiré du monde, rendered in the Russian as Priključenia Markiza Get, ili Žizn blagorodnoga človeka, ostavivšiva svijet, the most famous portion of which we probably know better at this point as Manon Lescaut. It also points to the traditional name for the 4th letter of the Russian alphabet, Glagol. We are dealing here actually with 2 very similar words in Russian that constitute a microcosm of Simeon's entire roleplay, Glagol with a hard sign and Glagol with a soft sign. The range of traditional meanings for the former can be expressed through glosses such as word, speech, utterance, and language. The definition of the latter is limited to its role as the name that we've given to a letter. At the same time, though, I think the interaction of these 2 terms is still illustrative of the function of Glagol in Krylov's play. By virtue of the phonetic similarity, which almost certainly points to a legitimate semantic link, Glagol hard sign and Glagol soft sign form a semantic web with all the notions of word, speech, utterance, and language on the one hand, and letter and script on the other. Both of these are equally important in the figure of Simeon. Although for Simeon himself, it happens simply to be the first marquis he can think of, for our purposes, it really appears to be the perfect moniker for a Russian masquerading as a Frenchman, the conflict of hard sign Glagol, whose masquerade, furthermore, is expressed primarily through the letter or soft sign Glagol. I'll explain that in the text of the play. The accent Simeon affects is reflected in the substitution of letters that comprises the changes he makes to his pronunciation. I've included a representative quote on number 4 on the handout. You'll see that it consists mostly of the simplification of some very Russian consonant clusters, and I've bolded the letters that should be otherwise in proper Russian. He also alters his grammar on at least one occasion so as to appear more convincingly French, and that part is also in that selection. Though the mechanics of the false Marquis's accent are largely limited to simple one-to-one correspondences between letters representing sounds foreign to the French language and those standing in for phones more easily pronounceable to a French speaker, at least one of these alternations can be argued to exemplify, in particular, the running conflict between the Russian and the French in A Lesson for Daughters. This is the most uniform characteristic of Simeon's linguistic dissimulation, the substitution of almost every incident of the uniquely Russian letter I with the vowel E, which is more common across the board of the languages of the world and is shared by Russian and French. This substitution is what lays bare the exact nature of Simeon's phonetic masquerade for Vyokarov, who perceives it himself as the disguise unravels. The conflicts of hard sign glagol and soft sign glagol are intertwined in this way. The point of altering the letters is to give an altered impression of the languages at play. So, the entire disguise depends on Simeon successfully altering the oral representation of his language, such that the only difference between Simeon the servant and Simeon the Marquis is really discernible in the accent. When he's not playing the role, of course, his Russian takes on the colorfully colloquial flavor with which Krylov was so famous for endowing his characters, particularly those of peasant stock. His oral performance on the stage notwithstanding, what we have on the page is the distinction in the letters Simeon uses to dress his speech in much the same way Mascarie, and Jodelet dress in the actual clothing of their masters, in the affected young ladies. As Marquis Glagol, therefore, Simeon is something of a sheep in wolf's clothing. He puts together this mask of Glagol from shiny French sounds in a Russian fashion, effectively translating the image of the French nobleman into a Russian persona. The example of Simeon invites us to consider the notion of translation as subterfuge, that is, to the idea that the translation of a foreign work constitutes its introduction into the target language, the target culture, dressed in the trappings of the target language, somewhat like Simeon introducing Marquis Glagol into the Vyokarov household. While Simeon's masquerade cannot be taken as a direct allegory of the translation of French cultural products into Russian, the manipulation to which he subjects his speech aptly illustrates the capacity of language as a given culture's surface appearance. Had Krylov undertaken a simple translation of Molière into Russian, this would have amounted to a French work existing in the Russian cultural milieu, with all the appearances of a Russian work, that is, a linguistic dissimulation of sorts, but remaining essentially French, that is, the property of the enemy, at its base. Thus, translation as a mode of rewriting does not necessarily signal the full appropriation of a foreign idea into a domestic context in and of itself. That is, the mere fact of the language in which a work is rewritten does not determine whether it lies at the privileged center of cultural discourse or in the shadows of the periphery. Just as Mascarie may float between the roles of valet and marquis, and more pertinently, just as Simeon is able to wander between Russian and French, a person engaging in rewriting manipulates the appearance of a text, in this case as a comment on a phenomenon taking place outside the text itself. The movement between languages signals a movement or shift in the axiological hierarchy of literary and cultural products. Full appropriation relies on the subversive nature of an act of rewriting that does not acknowledge the power of the original culture, and so does away with the danger inherent in embracing the enemy's ideas as one's own. A Finnish theorist of theater and translation, Sirku Aaltonen, calls this subversive act one in which the foreign is rewritten to serve the self without breaking away entirely from it. According to that definition, we can confidently say that Krylov's choice of model in Molière's The Affected Young Ladies is a subversive one. The fact that the origins of this Russian satire of Gallimania are situated in a French model, along with the circumstances of its popular reception, effectively demonstrates Krylov's success in transplanting a foreign cultural product into his domestic cultural sphere. Some critics, even in the face of all the evidence, go so far as to disqualify the characterization of A Lesson for Daughters as a translation, a copy, and a reworking, and to designate Krylov's play instead as an original work that just happens to take on the old theme of Gallimania. In other words, Krylov's appropriation of Molière's play into the Russian cultural sphere has been so successful as to veil A Lesson for Daughters' own true origins as a product of rewriting and to elevate it to the status of an original domestic work. This is for some people. Thus, A Lesson for Daughters is not only shrouded in the guise of a Russian work, but it also exemplifies subversion at its best. The play constitutes not just a retelling of a foreign story, but even goes so far as to speak against its very own origins. Through engaging in the act of rewriting, Krylov is able to subvert the original aim of Molière's play, adapting The Affected Young Ladies in such a way that the focus shifts from the issues of préciosité relevant to Molière to the more pressing concerns of the presence and reception of French language and culture in a Russia at war with France. His subversive rewriting of Molière's play attests to Russia's continuing progress on the path of removing the translated literature of the cultural hegemon to the periphery of Russian literature and culture, making more room for original Russian work at the center. While A Lesson for Daughters appears at face value only to thematize the rejection of French cultural encroachment, Krylov's play also depicts the processes of cultural appropriation in the stages of seduction, subterfuge, and finally subversion. And the play not only provides a commentary on the situation, but also constitutes a possible solution to the problem in and of itself. A Lesson for Daughters thus stands both as a record of the interactions between French and Russian culture at the beginning of the 19th century, as well as an example of what can be achieved for a culture at war that imports ideas originating in the land of the enemy. Thank you.